reasonable. It's reasonable to, for the employer, most courts would agree, for the employer, the old employer, to have an opportunity to maintain with another employee the relationship it has with a customer before the former employee that we set up with that customer gets a chance to go, you know, have a clean shot at them. And, you know, what's a reasonable time for that? Well, it could be a sales cycle, which could be a year, for example. It's not going to be the same for every company or in every industry, but that's one analysis. If you've got, suppose the person, what the person has of value, and of course different employees, some employees can have more than one of these things, but the person's an engineer or you know, somebody who's sort of doing market analysis or something like that. Well, what's a reasonable time to restrict an employee there? What do we need? It's like the conversation I'll try to have with employers is, obviously you'd like the employee never to work for a competitor, but think about what do you really need? And with this employee, it may be, gee, how long is it typically in our business before this employee's knowledge becomes important in the marketplace? If you're designing clothing and new lines, how long does it take from the time you're designing it before it's in the marketplace and you're really hurt by it? That's kind of, you know, factor in what your non-compete ought to be. So just want to be thinking through these things in the drafting process. And what I'll advise employers to do is we might ultimately, after we have our privilege discussions, might actually have the employer prepare a memo that kind of goes to the file or from Executive A to Executive B that says, this is why we're doing what we're doing. You get in litigation, you pull out that memo, shows the court, yeah, listen, we didn't just pick this time and this geographic scope and this restriction just because it sounded good. We thought about this, and we understand, Your Honor, that we don't like to put people out of work. You know, you as a judge, you don't like to put people out of work. But and so we were thinking ahead on that. We can explain to you, and it's not just because our lawyer made it up here in this case. It's because we thought about it when we wrote these things, and that's powerful stuff if you're trying to enforce these things. On this blue penciling, go back and think about that for a minute. If you're needing to draft for that, what you'll sometimes see, again, something to think about here. It's not in the sample that I've given you here. Is we may draft with sort of a menu, which says the employee is restricted in this restricted area for the period of time. The greatest period of time of the following that the court will enforce. A, 18 months. B, 12 months. C, 9 months. D, 6 months. So go back to this blue penciling where the court, it will strike language, but it won't rewrite it. The court can strike 18 months. It can strike 12 months. You're left with 9 months. I'd mentioned Indiana as a blue pencil state. I was with one of my colleagues recently, and there's actually some recent law in Indiana which sort of suggesting more strongly that you want to more explicitly do that, that a court suggested, listen, where there's a limit, not only are we only going to blue pencil, but there's a limit as to how hard a court should have to work to do that. You really need to spell it out if that's what you wanted. So that sort of scenario where you list out different tiers, if you will, is something you may want to think about in the drafting process. So, just focus quickly, this is partly a review, but dealing in multiple states, on the one hand, as I said before, you don't want a one-size-fits-all, especially a big company with lots of different kinds of employees. I mean, if all you're restricting is sales employees, well, you know, that may be different. But at the same time, you want a workable number of templates. Your clients aren't going to want you to, in a company of any size, aren't going to want to call their lawyer every time they need a new document. They're going to want a template they can use. But if you get into too many of them, it's just a recipe for mistakes. So that's one practical consideration, choice of law, and forum, as I mentioned. You want to tie the employees to the state that you're in which you're seeking venue. Often courts will find that consenting to jurisdiction, you know, that's enforceable, even if the employee is not spending a lot of time in that, in the sort of what I'll call the home state, the state in which you're seeking forum. But it's certainly helpful to document, this may be in the employment agreement, it may be elsewhere, the contacts that that the employee has with the home state. If that's something that can be reflected in the employment agreement, that's a good idea. But and typically the employee is doing business in various ways, comes to the home state for training, for meetings, for things like that. So you don't find a lot of these cases in which you've got a strong choice of forum not being enforced for reasons that the employee doesn't have sufficient jurisdictional contacts with the home state. But you do get those arguments, and anything you can do to sort of reinforce the employee's ties to the home state is helpful. Certainly a strong confidentiality program. Remember the three types of restrictive covenants. You can accomplish a lot with strong confidentiality in your agreement and in practice, of course, to the extent you've sort of run into problems because of state-by-state issues or enforcement issues with the non-compete. And as I mentioned before, if you're in California, and we may be saying this about Massachusetts in the not-too-distant future, we'll see. You may just need a separate document for certain states. There's a little bit of an art form, I think, with lots of practice to be able to draft a document that will kind of work pretty well across different kinds of laws. But no matter how good you are at it, I think if you can do it that works, say in an Ohio and a California, you're probably better than I am. So that's hard to do. Another really challenging, interesting aspect of the drafting process or dealing with various kinds of transitions. So, examples of that are Company A acquires Company B. You've got two sets of non-competes, for example, that look different. So that's because you're merging, you're acquiring, you're one company, you want those things to be similar and to work together. Another is that your company just decides that, hey, we want to implement these things. And you've got a bunch of current employees who aren't used to having them. That's another big transition. And then kind of almost a subset is the audit cleanup aspect, which is, and this is not uncommon. You've got 200 employees. They're supposed to have non-competes, but stuff happens. You move fast when you're hiring people, and you got 25 people who don't, and you want to get that cleaned up. In any of those, first you've got an employee relations issue. Probably you're changing the requirements on a person, but you've also got legal issues, and one of which, if you're thinking along with me here, is remember that first of the three state differences, the consideration, what constitutes sufficient consideration, and in all of those situations I just described, you're trying to give a non-compete, impose a non-compete on an employee who's already employed. So, if you're in a state in which continued employment is sufficient consideration, at least legally, I don't know about employee relations, but legally, that's not a problem. If you're in a state where additional consideration is required, you've got to have a plan for how you're going to do that. And then the other wrinkle is, if you're in both kinds of states, are we going to treat them differently in the two states? Suppose our decision is we're going to give each employee $1,000 to sign a non-compete, and you know, that's how you're going to do it. And I don't want to suggest that's completely bulletproof, because that is additional consideration, but you know, courts will look at, when they're looking at enforceability and the sort of reasonableness, fairness analysis, consideration that modest might, you know, a court might look at that and say, he got $1,000 for it. You know, we're not necessarily, we're going to be a little less inclined to enforce this to its fullest extent, but let's just assume that away for a minute. You're going to give $1,000 to each employee for signing a non-compete. Are you going to give it to the employees in the states where you don't have to legally, and you're weighing there the legal requirement versus the employee relations aspect of the employees who are saying, what the heck, they got $1,000 that I didn't just because they work in a different state, we're all doing the same thing. So, no single answer to that one, but you know, it's one that can come up, and just need to work that. Employers need to work that through with counsel and sort of play out the different scenarios. So, a few other drafting comments, and then I want to talk for just a minute about. Go to this one of these attachments, which I think is helpful on this. So first of all, got sort of, you know, five bullets here. Do these pretty quickly. Number one, an employment contract can be for at-will employment. Most of the you probably know this as a lawyer, but clients can be a little bit confused about that. So I will have the dialogue with some clients, which is, gee, have you ever thought about having a non-compete agreement? They'll say, well, you know, my employees are at will. Yeah, those two things don't one does not depend on the other. I've written plenty of non-compete agreements for at will employees. Now, you know, this whole consideration piece may factor into that in some way, but there's certainly no reason you can't have an at-will employee with a non-compete. As I say, you probably recognize that, but your clients may not. You know, definitely include non-solicitation employees and customers. Those are, if reasonably drawn, much easier to enforce. We'll talk about, you know, some employers just, you know, choose to go with that. And that can get you a lot of protections. I think it's important to have those in there. If your non-compete provision crashes and burns, you've still got that, and that can be very, very valuable. So you don't want to not have that in there. How much boilerplate? You know, employers, and what the sample I have given you, which is about just over five pages, is actually pretty modest. And you can see these things that are very, very long. And each piece of it, we're not going to go over this in great detail, but each piece of it is in there for a reason and has value. But there are situations where employers reasonably want something a little less intimidating looking. Suppose you're in that transitioning in non-competes with employees who haven't had them before, then the employer may say, gosh, this agreement's just so legal, and you can make reasonable business judgments. I mean, do you need to say in there in your agreement that the employee recognizes this is important and valuable and therefore can be enjoined? Probably not. Do we reference that in pleadings when we're trying to enforce these? Yes, we do. Do you see courts' cases being won or lost on that? Rarely, if ever. So you can trim these things back. You can make intelligent choices on those. Certainly wouldn't include trimming back choice of venue, for example, on that. Definability can be really important. Not going to spend a lot of time on that. But if your draft